I'm Tanya Mosley, and I want to thank you for listening to the Here and Now podcast. I also want to ask you to do something. Support your NPR station with a donation right now at donate.npr.org/now. Your contribution supports the reporting you hear every day, the latest from Washington, where a new administration is preparing to take over, and reporting from across the country on the surge of COVID-19 cases. Your donation ensures that you're hearing a range of voices, the experts, and also the everyday people who are experiencing all of this right now, like we all are. You're also helping to make possible those unforgettable interviews with authors, big thinkers, and creatives in the fine arts and popular culture. Those moments that make you want to listen every day. So make a donation to your NPR station now. Your contribution is more important than ever. Just go to donate.npr.org/now. We're building NPR and its member stations thanks to you. Now let's get to the news.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here Now. We're 3 days into the rollout of a coronavirus vaccine, but we're still a long way from the end of the pandemic. Dr. Anthony Fauci says to achieve true herd immunity, up to 85% of the U.S. population needs to be vaccinated. So now that people are getting inoculated, what is the next step? Let's ask Dr. Emily Landon. She's the Executive Medical Director of Infection Prevention and Control at the University of Chicago Medicine. Dr. Landon, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. Hi.
So if Dr. Fauci is correct, it's going to take months before most of the U.S. population gets inoculated. We really can't ask this question enough, but how can we keep ourselves safe and healthy while waiting for our doses of the vaccine?
Yeah, the most important thing right now is that we stick to our practices. We need to keep wearing our masks, keeping our distance, limiting our contacts, improving our ventilation. Outside is better than inside. Those things are even more important now than ever because we are nearing the finish line. I mean, it's still a ways off, but you can see it in the distance. And it would be so sad to lose loved ones now when they're so close to being able to get the vaccine.
I want to ask you a little bit about the particulars of inoculation and what that means for folks who have gotten the vaccine. Will people who have already been vaccinated need to continue wearing masks and social distancing?
Yeah. So until we know that we've achieved some kind of herd immunity and the numbers are coming down and we're not seeing spread, people are going to need to continue wearing masks because the vaccines, the ones that are being approved right now, are really effective. We don't know how long that immunity is going to last, and we don't know if it's going to wear off a little bit. And so some people won't be protected. We also have some remaining concerns about whether or not they actually prevent you from getting coronavirus at all or just getting sick with coronavirus, which if they protect you from just getting sick, then you could still carry it and pass it on to other people, which is, you know, sort of not the thing that we want to do. If you want to protect your mom, but you're a healthcare worker like I am, it's not just important that I get a vaccine. It's also important that I wear a mask when I visit with my mom until she can get her vaccine too.
Oh, these are important points. We don't know how long immunity lasts, and people who have taken the vaccine still can pass along the virus. Those are two very important points.
Yeah, we should learn more about them in the near future. So the main focus of the trials in order to get this done as quickly as possible and get these vaccines across the finish line and into the arms of Americans were to focus on safety and efficacy. And they do exactly that. They protect people from getting super sick with coronavirus and they are safe to use. But there are certainly more things that will be learned from the study population as we go forward. And hopefully we'll get favorable news for the duration and for their ability to prevent people from getting coronavirus at all. And then we'll be able to make some recommendations about cutting back on some of that PPE. But right now, we still need to stick with it.
Yeah, we can see the finish line. I want to talk to you about something else, though. There appears to be some frustration about the distribution of vaccine vials in Chicago, at Chicago area hospitals where workers were expected to be inoculated Tuesday but have yet to receive shipments. Governor Pritzker claims those hospitals might have misunderstood and that everything is actually according to schedule. What's the situation where you are?
Yeah, of course there are going to be concerns about this. This is one of the most complex procedures that anybody's ever tried to undertake. It's really logistically challenging. And the plans have changed a lot over the number of months. So this is not something that was unexpected for me or my hospital. We haven't received our vaccine at University of Chicago yet, but we're expecting it very soon. And we should start vaccinating people on Thursday. It's really important for people to remember whether you get vaccinated this Wednesday or next Wednesday is not that relevant in the grand scheme of things for the vast majority of people. Whether you get vaccinated this month as opposed to a year from now is a really big difference. And so we're going to vaccinate through the weekend to make sure that we can get as many people vaccinated as quickly as possible.
How are hospitals faring in Illinois?
Well, things are looking a little better than they were before Thanksgiving, which is great. There were a lot of new mitigations put into place and a lot of recommendations to have smaller gatherings and to avoid traveling for Thanksgiving. And a lot of people listened. You know, we're really pleased to say that the post-Thanksgiving sort of surge is a lot smaller than what we expected. We're not seeing a huge healthcare threatening surge right now. It's still not a great situation. We still have a lot of patients hospitalized, and we're having a lot of deaths in Illinois. Those are the people that were sick earlier in the big peaks of our wave in November.
Oh, that's interesting. You feel that people actually heeded the warnings during the Thanksgiving holiday. And those are, yeah, are the warnings that you are really pushing right now as we head into the Christmas holiday.
Yeah, certainly Christmas is looking a little safer than Thanksgiving was, but we can't take that for granted. You know, it's going to be really important for people to continue limiting their contacts and being extremely careful before they gather with any family or close friends. A lot of people chose to stay home for Thanksgiving, but the same rules apply to Christmas. If you're going to gather with family members, make sure you quarantine for 7 days and get tested before you do, and make sure that you avoid traveling and you keep those gatherings as small as possible.
That's Dr. Emily Landon, Executive Medical Director of Infection Prevention and Control at the University of Chicago Medicine. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
People have been gathering in communities across the country for months to call for racial justice and an end to police brutality. The city of Denver has been experimenting with how police are deployed. They're removing police from some emergency situations and sending in unarmed mental health professionals instead. Cities including Portland, Oregon, San Francisco, and New York have launched similar programs. Lee Patterson from member station KUNC has more on this non-police response unit and its service van called Star.
The Star van is a pretty ordinary-looking white vehicle. There's no siren, but it is full of supplies. Chris Richardson is one of the licensed social workers who staffs the van.
We have tampons, condoms, sunscreen, hand warmers, foot warmers.
STAR is short for Support Team Assisted Response. The two-person crew responds to 911 calls that aren't criminal. Instead, they're usually related to issues like homelessness, mental illness, and substance abuse.
Not too long ago, we had an individual that called and was just, she was living in a tent, and she called 911 and was just like, I can't get my meds, I'm not doing well.
So the STAR team picked up her meds. The paramedic explained how to take them, and they connected her with housing.
And it all happened just kind of like naturally.
The Star van is modeled off of a similar program in Eugene, Oregon, that's been around for decades. Unarmed paramedics and mental health clinicians go into these situations to help, whether that's by de-escalating a crisis or by getting people the services they need. It's such a different skill set that around 10% of calls to the Star van come from police and other emergency personnel on scene needing their help.
And it kind of changed the dynamic that they're part of working towards a solution and a creative way to help the community versus what's been kind of seen this year as law enforcement is part of the problem.
Denver has been piloting the program as anti-police protests in Colorado intensified over the summer months. And in cities across the country, especially following two high-profile incidents in Philadelphia and Rochester, New York, where black men died during or after violent encounters with police. Family members have said both were experiencing mental health crises. And it's a dynamic that is backed up by a recent study published in the Journal of Health and Social Work that found people with a severe mental illness are more likely to experience police violence regardless of their involvement in any crime.
It's something that officers dread, absolutely.
Maria Haberfeld is a professor of police science at John Jay College in New York. She says mental health situations are complex, and most officers only have minimal training in how to handle them. In terms of solutions like the STAR program, Haberfeld questions how much of an impact they can have. But
I think any model that takes away from police responsibilities that they're not well prepared to respond to is a great idea.
If our presence is something that escalates that and people can get the appropriate help and we don't need to be there, that's great.
Denver Police Chief Paul Pazin is a big fan of the STAR program and has been advocating for it for years. Recently, he says he's been fielding inquiries from all over the country and the state about Denver's program. But he describes this level of interest with caution.
They think, oh, STAR, this is, you know, the be-all, end-all type of deal. Well, it's fantastic. It's a great program. But by itself, it's not going to be the single solution.
Instead, Pazin describes the STAR van as one of a handful of options to get people the care they need, from a diversion program for low-level drug offenders to sending out mental health workers on certain emergencies with police. Right now, there's only one STAR van and a rotating group of people to staff it. But the Denver City Council likes what it's seeing, recently approving $1.4 million to fund the program next year. Back on the ground before starting his workday, Chris Richardson reflects on the past 6 months and the more than 600 calls they've responded to.
The fact we started a pilot in the middle of a pandemic with social unrest on an election year, I mean, I can't believe how smoothly it actually rolled out.
Despite this optimism, Richardson acknowledges the STAR van can't help everyone. For now, it only runs on weekdays between 10 and 6 p.m.
You know, it's not saying I can help, 50,000 people in Denver. It's I can help one person at a time with whatever it is that they're dealing with and make them feel like that they have someone in their corner.
Richardson's hope is that STAR will eventually expand to service the entire city. For Here and Now, I'm Lee Patterson.
Today, President-elect Joe Biden named former presidential rival Pete Buttigieg to be his transportation secretary. If he's confirmed, Buttigieg would become the first openly gay cabinet member.
Travel, in my mind, is synonymous with growth, with adventure, even love, so much so that I proposed to my husband, Chasten, in an airport terminal. So don't let anybody tell you that O'Hare isn't romantic.
Also, there's a congressional deal to help people struggling during the pandemic, or at least it might be close at hand. We're going to talk about this and other issues with Matt Mikowiak, who's a Republican strategist, and Jamal Simmons, who's a Democratic strategist. Hello, Matt.
Howdy.
And hello, Jamal.
Hi, how are you?
Just wanted to get the voices out there. Jamal, you first. On the issue of a relief package from Congress, yesterday on All Things Considered, Senator Bernie Sanders made the argument that any deal should include direct payments to people in need. Let's hear from him.
I do not believe that it is appropriate for members of Congress to go back to their families for the Christmas holidays while so many millions of families in this country are struggling just to stay alive.
So many people are hurting. CNN is reporting that stimulus checks might be half of what they were earlier this year. That's when $1,200 checks were mailed out. Jamal, is this something the Democrats can actually take credit for?
It certainly is something Democrats can take credit for because Republicans were pushing for a deal that didn't have direct payments. So if you get any direct payment, that's probably because the Democrats put it in there. Bernie Sanders may have a point. $600 isn't a lot of money for people who are struggling, but it's more than nothing. And so where we were because of Mitch McConnell over the last few months is that there was a lot of nothing. I think you can't take out the idea, what we're reading, that in the Georgia Senate race, this idea of direct payments has become a big issue for Senate candidates Warnock and Ossoff. And it might be that Mitch McConnell relented because he's got to do something to help those Republicans running down there.
Matt, I want to ask you about that. The Democrats, as Jamal mentioned, are making Republican opposition to stimulus checks a big part of their closing argument. Are the two GOP senators, Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue, in trouble because of that?
No, I don't think it's probably, limited to that central issue. I do think it is an issue because the stimulus effort has been a major issue in D.C. It still doesn't appear to be a final agreement, although it looks like it's going to be maybe today or early tomorrow. And it seems like the leaders on both sides have agreed they have to do something and that there now is a little bit more compromise on both sides than there was before the election. You did have Speaker Pelosi say after the election that she finally admitted she was, you know, not willing to compromise because she wanted to see how the election went. She thought her hand would be strengthened if Biden won. She just didn't expect to lose so many House seats, so her hand was weakened, actually. So I do think we're going to get a reasonable compromise.
Jamal, I wonder what you think the extent is that the slowness of Congress's response on stimulus checks puts Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue on the defensive or even jeopardizes their candidacies.
It does put them on the defensive, the Republican candidates down there. I think that the Democrats have been, again, Warnock and Ossoff have really been making this case. Listen, the question is on the table now, are we going to turn our back as a country on Trumpism and try to move forward where people of differing opinions can come together, have different priorities, figure out a way to negotiate their differences and get something done for the country? Or are we going to try to keep the Senate in the hands of Mitch McConnell, who not just during the Trump presidency, but during the Obama presidency, has been a total stumbling block, a roadblock for moving things forward with any kind of, you know, group negotiating. So that's the question on the table. What happens in that Senate race? Voting for the Democrats is probably going to make things a lot easier to get progress for the country.
Matt Mikowiak, we're still talking about Georgia now, and I want to ask you about specifically Joe Biden, who was back on the campaign trail yesterday for the first time since the election, stumping for the Democrats and recalling his own victory in the state last month and President Trump's legal efforts to overturn it. Let's hear from Biden.
Georgia wasn't going to be bullied. Georgia wasn't going to be silenced. Georgia certainly wasn't going to stand by and let Donald Trump or the state of Texas or anyone else come in here and toss out your votes.
Matt, you said earlier that you think that Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue, the Republican incumbents, are not going to be hurting because of the slow response on the stimulus checks. The runoff election is 3 weeks away. What does it boil down to at this point?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you have a pretty clear distinction in both these races, and I think the ultimate election results in both races are going to be pretty close. I mean, these two races have been nationalized. It's not really about local issues; it's about national issues. It's about whether you believe the Democrats, you know, having control of the United States Senate would be a good thing for the country or not. I think the silent majority of the country would like to see divided government. I think most people want to see the parties come together, that they realize that you wouldn't have extreme actions taken if both parties had to be invested and had to be on board to do major things. Certainly, I think that, you know, that both Democratic candidates do have some pretty left-wing positions. You're seeing that case be pressed time and time again by the Republican candidates against the Democratic candidates. These races are going to be close. Runoffs are highly unpredictable because you don't know who's going to turn out. And this is, of course, occurring, 4 days after New Year's, with early voting during Christmas and Hanukkah. So it's really an unusual time frame to have two runoff elections where the stakes are absolutely astronomical.
I wonder, though, what you both make of what's happening in the Republican Party now, especially given that Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell sent a major signal to other Republicans yesterday, finally recognizing Joe Biden as president-elect. Here he is.
Many millions of us had hoped the presidential election would yield a different result. But our system of government has processes to determine who will be sworn in on January the 20th. The Electoral College has spoken.
And then President Trump spoke through a tweet. He tweeted, "Mitch, 75 million votes, a record for a sitting president by a lot. Too soon to give up. Republican Party must finally learn to fight. People are angry." We should note McConnell's memoir is called The Long Game. And I wonder if, Jamal, you think that he's playing the long game here and whether he is likely to emerge unscathed.
Yeah, the president is engaging in some obfuscation. You know, for him to point out that the number of votes he got was more than any sitting president ever got, that's a great thing for his memoir and his library, but it's not a great thing for winning an election when the Democrat got millions more votes than the Republican. So he got a record, but Joe Biden got an even bigger record. Listen, this country is ready to move past Donald Trump and his grafting, grifting type of government. What we're seeing now is he's still raising money. Instead of putting money into the Georgia Senate race, he's raising money for his own political benefit that will benefit him afterwards. You've got people leaving the Defense Department. The Attorney General resigned this week. This government, even in its last throes, is in disarray. And I think the country is ready to move on to something that's more productive for everyone.
Matt, what do you think the future is, though, for Republicans who are not letting go of election fraud claims, even though as of now, there has not been a court victory and the claims are groundless?
Yeah, look, Joe Biden is going to be sworn in on January 20th. I think most sober people who've looked at this over the last few weeks have recognized that's the truth. As you've seen these lawsuits not succeed, it's become really, you know, entirely undeniable at this point. That said, look, if they have credible evidence that they want to present in court under oath, where lawyers are bound by, you know, the rules that lawyers have to follow, then I want to see it. I think every American should want to see evidence of election fraud. Any illegal vote is a vote that counts against.
Well, they certainly had a lot of chances.
They have. And look, I think of the 30 or so lawsuits that have existed, something like 25 of them were dismissed for standing reasons, not for reasons based on the substance of what was being argued. Look, the Trump legal effort has been disastrous. It's been pathetic. Now, I do think there may be a couple more reasonable arguments being made recently. But look, the die is cast. It's clear Joe Biden's going to get sworn in on January 20th. It is true that Trump still has a hold on the Republican Party, and that's why you're seeing some of these Republican members continue to fight. I'm interested in fighting to try to ensure that our elections have integrity. I'm not interested at this point in trying to overturn the Electoral College, which is just simply not going to happen.
Well, I think, you know, just to get on Matt's point here, if we have a coalition of the rational, right, a coalition of people who are willing to acknowledge facts and science and math, Democrats and Republicans can come together. And on a day after we lost Don Fowler, who's one of the giants of the Democratic Party, and many of us are in mourning, and we see Pete Buttigieg appointed as Transportation Secretary, who's the future of the party, I think these are the kind of political figures who are not that ideological, who are interested in finding ways for people to come together and to get the country moving forward. And hopefully Republicans will do that going into the Biden administration.
We're going to let it go there. Jamal Simmons, Democratic strategist, Matt Mikowiak, Republican strategist. Thank you very much, both of you, for speaking to us. Thanks.
Thank you.
Support for this podcast comes from the Boston Foundation. For more than a century, a resilient city and region have relied on the Boston Foundation to bring people together to solve our most serious problems. The Foundation's work has been strengthened by hundreds of people who've left legacies to support our community. Leaving a charitable legacy at the Boston Foundation is a great way to have an impact now and in the future. Learn more at tbf.org/partner.
Could a watch on your wrist or a ring on your finger detect COVID-19? Well, maybe. Researchers at Stanford University are among several groups looking into whether wearable devices like smartwatches can help people identify a coronavirus infection before it spreads. Aaron Broden has been writing about this and this research for our partners at STAT, the Health and Medicine publication. Hey, Aaron.
Hey.
So besides just counting steps or tracking your heart rate, scientists really think wearables like Fitbit and Apple Watches might actually be able to detect early coronavirus signs. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so this definitely does not mean, you know, if you have a Fitbit, if you have an Apple Watch, if you have an Oura Ring, you are protected against COVID. But this is early research, and essentially what it says is that by tracking things, including your temperature, your sleep and activity levels, and most importantly, your heart rate variability, we can start to see early signs that people might be infected with coronavirus. And critically, this is even before people start to even feel sick, feel any symptoms at all.
How was the Stanford University study conducted, and who participated in it?
So I have been looking at about three studies, all of which just conveniently happened to come from California, where I'm from. At Stanford, they honed in on heart rate variability because for them, it appeared to be one of the key signalers of a potential coronavirus infection. And that's because when the body starts to mount a response to a foreign threat, what you tend to see is heart rate picks up quite rapidly. And they saw that in their study, that compared with people's baselines, people's normal average heart rate over time, they saw a noticeable uptick in kind of the pitter-patter of their hearts.
for this UC San Francisco study, they partnered with Aura, the makers of smart rings. Can you tell us more about their study and participants?
What it is essentially is it's a wearable that's just a ring. But for this study specifically, Aura homed in on temperature changes, and they found that their temperatures picked up days before they felt sick. And this was something that they could see in an algorithm that they built and were tracking.
People interested in tracing COVID-19 exposure through their Fitbit or smart ring also have to think about something else that we talk a lot about when it comes to new technology, and that's the data collected. So who has access to this data?
It does seem like they're going to good lengths here to ensure that the data stays with the patient, for example, or user, I should say. For example, a lot of them take what's known as kind of a federated learning approach, I believe, where some of the data gets stored specifically on your device rather than floated up to the cloud where it can be shared with lots of folks. Then when it is shared, your personal identifiers, your name, your age, those sorts of things are scraped from that information so that then, you know, a bunch of anonymized, aggregated data is kind of floats up to the cloud, and there it can be analyzed without connecting any specific data point down to any specific human being.
How promising is this research, and when will this feature be available for consumers?
It is really early, but it is really promising. But a lot of these devices are not cheap. If and when this research does turn into actual products that people can use, I hope that there is a sustained effort to ensure that there's equitable access to this stuff.
That's Erin Brodin with our partners at STAT, the Health and Medicine publication. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
For 17 years, the federal government had not used the death penalty. The Trump administration changed that. It has executed 10 federal inmates this year and is putting to death three more by the time the president leaves office next month. The Death Penalty Information Center tracks capital punishment in the U.S., and the group's annual report is out today. Robert Dunham is the group's executive director. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Robert, when was the most recent federal execution?
The most recent federal executions were last week. There were three prisoners who were slated for execution. Two of the executions happened, Brandon Bernard and Alfred Bourgeois, and they brought to 10 the number of federal civilian executions in 2020.
Has the Trump administration made part of its policy the resumption of executions if there hadn't been any for 17 years?
I think that's right. We've seen an unparalleled politicization of the Justice Department, and the death penalty is part of that. After no one had executed anyone in 17 years, this administration has scheduled more executions for a shorter period of time than at any time in either the 20th or 21st centuries. We've got to go back to Grover Cleveland's presidency in 1896 before we have numbers that are comparable to this. And doing it during a transition period between a president who is a strong supporter of the death penalty and a president who said that he seeks to end the federal death penalty, that only underscores the political nature of what we're seeing.
We should also insert here one of your other findings, that federal executions happen more often than executions at the state level for the first time ever. Have states cut back?
What we've seen this year is unlike anything in American history. You know, the numbers this year for executions and new death sentences are artificially low because of the pandemic. But courts were in the same posture for the federal government and the state government. And that doesn't explain why we had fewer state executions than any time in 37 years and the most federal executions in any time since the 1800s. I think that underscores two things. One is how historically out of step the Trump administration has been, both with presidential administrations going back more than a century and a half and with the current practices of the states. What it comes down to is the states recognized there was no need to execute anybody during the middle of a pandemic when doing so placed the public health at risk. But the federal government prioritized executing prisoners now over protecting the public health. And as a result of that, when the rest of the country, most of the rest of the country, was trying to save people's lives and protect their health, the federal government plunged forward with a record spree of executions.
You say that the federal government has had a record spree and is out of step with the American public. What does current public opinion say about capital punishment?
The Gallup poll from November this year said that public support for the death penalty was, in the abstract, at 55%. That's 55% who said they're in favor of capital punishment. That's the lowest number it has been in 50 years. And the level of opposition to capital punishment was at the highest level since 1966. And we have to read that in conjunction with other recent polls, where Gallup found that 60% of Americans, when asked which was a preferable punishment, life without parole or the death penalty, chose life. That's been a continued movement away from capital punishment, and public support has dropped from 80% in the 1990s by 25 percentage points. And interestingly, Gallup found that support for the death penalty has dropped among virtually every demographic group in the United States.
But it still sounds like the majority support it.
In the abstract, that's true. The American public view of capital punishment is nuanced. I think that while people don't like the death penalty, a majority still want it there as an option in some extreme cases.
Federal executions are going to continue into January. There is a woman who will be executed, Lisa Montgomery, the first woman executed by the federal government in nearly 70 years. In your findings, is there still a racial disparity in the use of the death penalty? Is it still applied mostly to black men?
The death penalty is disproportionately applied to defendants of color, black and Latinx. But what we really see is a double layer of discrimination. First, there's a white preference. When it comes to designating a case as a capital case, a murder is more likely to be solved if there's a white victim. A murder is more likely to be capitally prosecuted if there's a white victim, particularly if the victim is a woman. So initially, we see a white victim preference for cases going into the death penalty system. And then when you look within the groups of cases that make it into capital trials, African-Americans and Latinx defendants are more likely to be sentenced to death.
And remind us how many people are on death row now at the state and federal levels.
Currently in the United States, there are 52 people on federal death row. Now, that's a tiny portion of death row nationwide. There are 2,500 people who are still on death row across the country.
Robert Dunham, thank you for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Robert Dunham is Executive Director of the Death Penalty Information Center. There's a link to the group's report on capital punishment in 2020 at hereandnow.org.
A federal order preventing evictions for unpaid rent is set to expire at the end of the month. Congress is now debating whether to extend it, and housing for millions of people hangs in the balance. Among them is a health worker in Atlanta who fell behind on her rent after she caught the coronavirus. Stephanie Stokes from WABE shares her story.
Ray and her two sons all live in the same apartment complex, a modern-looking building near the center of Atlanta. She asks that we not use her full name to protect the privacy of her children. Her younger son lives with her. He's just finishing high school. She says her older son rents a different apartment upstairs.
Yeah, we're really close. I'm a single mom, and it's always just been me and the boys. So we're like this, you know.
Like this. She crosses her fingers. Ray is proud of her sons. They've been through a lot together.
You know, I guess most single moms could agree, it's a roller coaster. Sometimes you're up, sometimes you're down. But you just work through it.
That's what she's doing now. She became a traveling nurse before the pandemic started. She'd fill in around the country wherever hospitals were short-staffed. The contracts could cover her family's needs. In the spring, as the COVID-19 outbreak grew, she got a call.
To work in New York and New Jersey. So I said, okay, this is something new to all of us, but I need to work. So I took the assignment.
Ray treated COVID patients for a month in New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. Hospitals were still figuring out the virus. She says it was scary. And one day on the job, she developed a bad cough. She had to go to the ER herself.
They did the x-ray. They said, she's staying with us. She has everything that we've been seeing here. She has it. And I ended up spending almost 2 weeks in the hospital. It was bad. I mean, my oxygen was really low. It was bad.
When Ray improved enough to leave the hospital, she still had to quarantine in New York. By the time she returned home, she'd been without income for more than a month. The nursing company paid her hospital stay, but not sick leave. And in Atlanta, she had trouble finding more work.
You know, I had added, you know, my travel onto my resume, and I'm like, well, I've worked with COVID, so this should be a good thing for these hospitals here in Georgia, but nothing.
It was late summer. COVID cases were declining. She never heard back about unemployment either. She began to fall behind on bills. Her older son upstairs tried to help, but he'd also lost work during the pandemic. Soon he fell behind too. Within a couple months, they both got eviction notices. Ray doesn't get hung up on the irony that after she helped COVID-19 patients, no one helped her. She says she didn't create the system. Still, she wants people to know what can happen to families like hers in this system.
I budget. I'm not rich. And I'm pretty sure I'm like a lot of parents. Like, you want your kids to live in a decent environment where you know they're going to be safe. I'm sorry. And you will work hard to do it. And even if you're budgeting, it could be that one thing in my situation, that one thing this time was COVID, and it sent everything downhill.
Now, with coronavirus cases around the country soaring, traveling healthcare companies are hiring again. And by the next time we speak, Ray has accepted an assignment in Rhode Island. She's still figuring out how she will make up her family's past due rent. The federal eviction moratorium protects them until at least December 31st. For Here and Now, I'm Stephanie Stokes.
Okay, an alert to all you parents listening with kids out there. We're about to talk about Santa. And more specifically, those who play Santa each year. This year, there will be no long lines and sitting on Santa's lap. Masks and social distancing make it really difficult for these guys who play Clauses to connect with kids. But some of them are getting creative, doing it virtually through Zoom or setting up appointment-only visits. And joining us now to share some tricks of the trade this year is Tom Carmody. He's been playing Santa for 16 years in Westminster, Colorado, and he's the founder of the Rocky Mountain chapter of the International Brotherhood of Real Bearded Santas. And Tom, you've been meeting with kids mostly online this year. What's been the reaction when you see them on the screen?
Excitement, joy, and most of all, the reality that Santa is going to be visiting their home Christmas Eve.
Oh, I can imagine that. Have many of them asked you that because of the pandemic? They actually wonder whether or not Santa will be visiting this year.
Yeah, and one of the things that I tell them is that the virus is like Grinch. The only difference is that at the end, the Grinch found his heart. The virus has no heart. I assure them that Santa is going to be there because he has limited contact with the human world. Mm. He was with the elves at the North Pole.
Right. Well, we spoke with another Santa this week, Shikundi Salisbury, who's been meeting with kids and taking photos for free in person at a mall in Seattle. And he says families now have to RSVP before they can come visit, but they do come visit in person. Let's listen.
I thought that there would be less demand, but there's a lot of demand for an in-person Santa. One of the sad parts about being Santa this year is that little kids, right, so older kids most certainly know to, you know, have their mask on, and we're going to socially distance from Santa, but, you know, 22 months to 23 months, 24 months, whatever, those kids, when they see Santa, they'll break away from mommy or daddy's hand, and they'll run towards you, and they want to hug you. That's been a challenge, or awkwardness, if you will, around being Santa this year.
Oh, I can imagine the awkwardness of that, because you want to take in all of those kids' joy, but at the same time, you have to socially distance. Can you relate to that?
Oh, absolutely can relate to that. You know, having worked malls for 4 years at the beginning of my career, but, you know, I've seen some of that in the faces of the children online as well. And it is an expression of belief. And, you know, when you get older children, you have the opportunity also to talk about what's really important at Christmas time, and that's the spirit of Christmas, not necessarily the person of Christmas. It's the spirit of giving and the spirit of love. And as long as they carry that in their heart, they'll always hear the bell. You know, the quote from the Polar Express, if you hear the bell, you still believe.
Oh, it's so true. You also mentor other Santas in your region. What kinds of conversations are you having with them?
Well, you know, I expressed to them, you know, that we are going to have more Christmases. And I give the other Santas, especially the newer Santas, I help them understand how to stay safe. There is no foolproof way to protect yourself from the virus except following the CDC guidelines. And the one thing that Santas that are thriving in this environment have to do is think outside the box. I happen to have a sleigh, and as I contemplated, what can I do in my own neighborhood? And I had the back of my sleigh set up so the parents could take photos of the children where I was up in the sleigh and the children sat on the back of the sleigh. And I've decided to make it a yearly thing.
Right. Like, there are new ways, there are new modes that we're learning. It's not all doom and gloom. Like you said, just having a little bit of imagination, we can still keep our traditions, like meeting
absolutely.
For Santa and just socially distancing. I want to ask you one last thing. How do you give a virtual hug?
Oh, I've done the Children's Hospital here in Denver as a virtual Santa for the last 8 years. And you learn to reach towards the camera, and you have the children reach towards the camera, and you just close your eyes and imagine that you are hugging each other. And they're able to feel that. And you can create that feeling even in a virtual world. You know, you can't have the personal contact, but you can still have the heart-to-heart contact.
And you know what? I feel we're having a heart-to-heart contact. Just in your voice, I can feel your virtual hug. And I really thank you for this.
You're so welcome.
Tom Carmody is from Westminster, Colorado, and is one of the many people across the country playing Santa this Christmas season. Thank you again, and you have a Merry Christmas.
Take care now. Ho, ho, ho. Merry Christmas.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. This is Here and Now.